Welcome to Anthony Ploga Music. This is Eddie Ludema, producer of the show. In part two, Jason and Aaron dig deeper into performance psychology, their strategies for dealing with COVID, and the groundbreaking research Aaron is doing at the Royal College, including something called distributed simulation. But before we jump back into the conversation, we'd like to share a message from our friends at Dorico, the cutting-edge music notation and engraving system from Steinberg.
Create music that moves with Dorico 5, the brand new version of the music notation and composition software from Steinberg. Packed with new features throughout the application, it's the perfect time to update from your current version or to try Dorico for the first time. You can start for free with Dorico SE or Dorico for iPad, which now allow projects with up to 8 players. Or step up to Dorico Elements, which now allows projects of unlimited size and features an expanded engrave mode. For professional use, choose Dorico Pro, which has many unique features you won't find in any other software. Visit www.steinberg.net/Dorico today and make more time for music.
You know, we have actually have so many areas to get to. We've only covered the first project. So could you just quickly go through the HARTS project, the HARTS professional project, and the MedTech connection project?
We might not want to include a lot of the detail on these, but I can very quickly just mention them. So we have a project that we've just finished called HARTS. It stands for the Health, Economic, and Social Impact of the Arts. So it's a funny acronym that you'll find in various academic projects. But we're looking at the extent to which the arts, music and the arts, makes a difference to public health. And we see, and so from a scientific perspective, we want to understand, well, to what extent can music and the arts actually enhance health in society, mental health and physical health? And so we have a lot of data now from tens of thousands of people demonstrating that an engagement with the arts, even when you control for educational level, income, and so on, engagement with the arts on a long-term basis has significant impacts on health and well-being. So older adults, for instance, who are much more involved with the arts, going to museums, galleries, concerts, even again, as I say, controlling for income level and educational level, those older adults who more consistently engage with the arts have lower levels of depression, lower levels of loneliness, they're more socially connected, and so on. So we have data here that's drawn from very large-scale epidemiological studies to demonstrate the value of music and the arts in society. That's our HARTS project.
Could I just say something just quickly? My wife and I, for about 6 seasons, and then we were cut off. It's a 7-season series, and I forget the name of it, but it's an English series about a police force that deals with other corrupt policemen. Do you know the name of that series? I forget the name of the series, but anyway, we were quite taken by it, and there were 2 male stars and a female star. And it turns out that the female star, and I forget her name, excuse me, but that she either founded or is very much involved with a choir called the Dementia Choir. And everybody in this choir has dementia, and yet they get together and they sing, and that helps them. And to me, that seems to be like a perfect example of what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's Line of Duty, I think you're
Line of Duty, that's it. Yes, yeah. Yes. Great series for Americans who have not seen it.
I was trying to find it. Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah.
Well, you know, what's interesting for us in doing this work is that we do tend to do this sort of work looking at music and the arts and their impact on health through our students as well. So we also devise opportunities for students to go out and to engage with older adults or mental health service users. And the whole rationale behind that is to say, well, look, what you can do is to obsess about getting on stage at the Wigmore Hall. And yeah, you might have that goal in mind, but what you can also do is to engage with the public in a different way through mental health service users, through nursing homes, through hospitals, and you can actually make a difference and see that difference to other people's lives. And making a difference in those people's lives can make a difference in your own life. So looking at the sort of mutual beneficial part of engaging in community music making in health contexts. So that's why a conservatoire is interested in looking at this particular issue, because we want students to develop new career pathways, to have other rewarding opportunities to perform, and to go out and see firsthand how their music making does directly impact people that they're performing for and performing with.
I think it's really important that, you know, modern day study at music college, we're not, you know, just what Aaron's talking about there is that we're not just trying to make players. I think that's the key thing, is we're not trying to just make the next second trumpet of whatever orchestra it might be. That's not the only thing we're trying to do. What we want to do is we want to inspire people to, be the best version of themselves, but then we also want to make sure that we can open doors while they're at college. You know, if we manage to keep the opportunities so diverse that actually somebody discovers something that they're really good at or something that really inspires them that they want to take part in, if that is inspiring the next generation of musicians, which I think, to be honest, is something that there aren't enough people who are passionate about doing that. And I think... it's important that we make sure that all those doors are open for our students, so that we're not just making, you know, a conveyor belt of players leaving the college. Because I don't, if I'm honest, I don't want. I think making a brass player is quite easy in many ways. You know, someone who is a very good technician is a very easy thing to do if you have the right teacher, if you have the right tools. Then I think you're kind of not going to struggle to do that. But actually finding your own unique career path, you know, the things that make you and the things that actually inspire you and are going to give you that fulfillment through your career, I think those are the things which are almost more exciting.
Yeah, you know, you can teach students to go out and set goals for themselves, but if they can find their own purpose, that is potentially much more, you know, fulfilling and gives them a whole well of resource that they can turn back to throughout their careers.
So your third project is called Hearts Professional. I'm clicking them off here, which I'd actually like Jason to talk about, because this is, and then you can comment on what Jason has to say. This is the effect of COVID.
Jason, do you know anything about this project?
No.
Okay, I'd like to hear Jason from a performer's standpoint, how COVID affected you.
Sure. COVID was terrifying. COVID was absolutely terrifying. Most musicians in London were all freelance. Even though I am a principal trumpet of a London orchestra, I'm not salaried. I'm paid by call. You know, there was limited support available for a long time. We had a couple of months of not really knowing what was going on, as I'm sure many, many people did throughout the industry and also in many other industries. And so with that, there was kind of a sense of relief because we didn't have to go to work and there was this novelty of being at home. But then after maybe a week, 2 weeks, this kind of underlying stress, this fear, just that it would never go away, was just there because nobody knew what was going on. You know, there was political campaigns telling us all to retrain, which my wife did. My wife's a freelance violinist, and she did a massage therapy course because she didn't know what an industry would be left to go back to. I mean, we've been very fortunate that there is an industry that still exists. But I think the thing that I personally found so difficult was leading up to the pandemic. I kind of, you know, I talked a little bit about how many concerts we were doing. Everything was just nuts. The schedule was mad. There were weeks where I'd be doing kind of 5 12-hour days in a row, whether it was teaching or performing or recording, whatever it was. It was nuts. And I think if there was ever a point in my career where I was heading for burnout, it was then. It was like March 2020. And I think I got that year right, didn't I? Yeah. Although COVID made all the years kind of just blur into one and they've become very difficult to distinguish. But so in many ways, I was very glad for the pandemic because it meant that I just had to stop. because what I was doing was wasn't sustainable. But what I hadn't realized was that my coping mechanism had been to just do so much stuff one after another that I never had to stop and think about anything. I never had to stop about, you know, we'd go from doing 4 mile of fives and then we go straight into like recording a big film. And then I'd go and do the Haydn trumpet concerto and then I'd record another big film. And it was like, I was just doing so much all the time. I never had a chance to stop and think. And actually when things did stop, it was great. I was like, oh, I've got all this freedom. But then one of the first things that did come back was the commercial recording stuff. And again, it was never really something that I've really had to think about. I just rock up, play some stuff, and go home. Have a nice time, try your best, and that's it. But with nothing else in my diary, and I get a phone call and say, I get an email and say, can you come and do this session in 2 weeks' time? I was like, yeah, sure. All of a sudden, all I can think about is a 3-hour session in 2 weeks' time. And it was just, it was all consuming. I struggled to do anything. It was really, really difficult because I was just living with this worry all the time. So I went and I got a CBT therapist.
What is CBT?
Cognitive behavioral therapy.
Okay.
And it kind of, it focuses in, well, for me anyway, we focused in on worry. And how I had made, a lot of them were ideas that I had created, or there were things like terms such as catastrophizing. And one of the terms that kept coming up was perfectionism and black and white thinking, you know, and this idea of things being good or bad. And I would like to say that I now try and relate to that concept as being false as much as possible, although I'm not going to say that I never think that. And I mean, that was something that really helped me, but actually COVID was tough because coming back to performing, you know, doing these concerts to empty halls, you know, and it was being filmed. There was obviously that element of a safety net because it was like, if it goes wrong, we'll just try again. But then all of a sudden when you ended up like doing your first concerts to a couple of people, it was terrifying. Absolutely terrifying, because it's like, I've only got one go to get this right. And the thing is, you know, we weren't really doing hugely difficult repertoire to start off with. And then as soon as the repertoire started getting bigger, as orchestras could afford to put on larger pieces and that sort of stuff, the pressure mounted up very quickly. And I mean, I'm so glad that I did go and speak to someone about, and again, it wasn't performance specific therapy. It was more, you know, just about living my life as a human being. And again, trying to disassociate from the label of a musician and basically being able to live with the fact that I'm not a unicorn. And in that, and by what I mean by that is that I'm not a perfect thing, because it's, you know, it's not this thing doesn't exist. Like, I'm chasing something which is an impossibility. And I think the difficulty that I found through COVID, and to be honest, it's one of the things that has come out of the recording industry, is that, you know, you stick a CD on and it's perfect. Great. And then, you know, and I've read reviews which say, it was a shame that the second horn split that note in the third movement. And it's like, well, hang on, why are you coming to watch a live concert if you don't, like, if that's what you're expecting, go and put a CD on. Like, you know, that stuff happens. And I think, you know, actually through COVID, because there were all those live concerts which weren't live, which were patched, probably with like a 4-hour patching session beforehand and afterwards, we give out these fake ideas of what performing is. And actually, I'm sure that 90% of the concerts, if they were actually put out how they sounded, would be littered with mistakes. And to be honest, that is what live music should be. It should be genuine, and it should be what people are trying to say. Whereas, and I'm not, you know, trying to put down anything that anybody put out over COVID, because the access to the arts on the internet was amazing. But I do think that now people have a slightly skewed image of what performing is. And with that, since then, we've had to deal with this almost added pressure to be perfect, because that's what we were given for 2 years. And now it's something that, well, it's impossible. We can't ever live up to those expectations. And something that I'm definitely having to speak to my students about is managing that expectation. We aren't perfect. We can never be. And it's all we can do is try our best. And actually, another one of my colleagues, Phil Cobb at the LSO, one of his favorite sayings is amble on and have a bash.
Say that again.
Amble on and have a bash.
Oh, okay.
That's what, and it's so simple, yet actually that's all you can do. All you can do is go on stage and try your best, because nobody can ask any more of you than that.
Aaron has been nodding his head in agreement with everything you've been talking about. So Aaron, go ahead.
So with the research that we've been doing around COVID, the first point about that Jason, you mentioned earlier, was the sheer sense of financial desperation that so many people felt when the rug was completely pulled out from under them with so little security. And so, what we were trying to do in some of our research is to scour internationally different practices of looking at basic guaranteed incomes or minimum pay for creators, trying to look at different solutions that we could then go back and propose to government to see if we could have some sway there. So we know that from audiences in terms of, or the general public, there was a real craving to get back in to hear live performance. We did see a lot of people moving into territory where a lot of artists moving into different territories and trying to make the most out of digital interfaces and online performances. But across the sector, many people felt that they really need to be upskilled in how to do this effectively. So yeah, there were one or two exceptional examples, but quite a lot of people who were losing work were also feeling, well, I can't keep up with all the technical and digital demands that are going to be needed of me in order to live my life like this. And in terms of retraining, we had just the most horrific advice to some artists about, going off and doing something. We absolutely know from a lot of research that musicians and artists contribute incredibly to not only the economics and the financial health of the UK and, in fact, most Western countries, but they are directly having an input on the actual physical and mental health of the public too. And what we were seeing is that a lot of young performers they felt that they had no real alternative but to just leave because there was no financial future. And so if we stop the flow into the arts of these young aspiring creators, then we are facing basically a public health crisis in the future, because we won't have those people providing the sort of engagement that we know can have such an impact on aspects like social connectedness and loneliness and depression that we see within society. So, we've made sets of recommendations. I gave a presentation to the UK's government's Department for Culture, Media and Sport, and with a series of recommendations. Now, all of these recommendations were made even before the current cost of living crisis that we're facing. So we've seen effectively no action on that front. So we're putting together yet another proposal to do more work on the policy side. We need to translate this research that we're doing and aim it at policymakers and people who can actually make a difference to the way that we're actually governed and supported. Whether that's going to work or not, I don't know. We'll see. But we very typically, from my point of view, as a mere academic, I come along, I do research. We deal with students, but the work in terms of engaging policymakers is incredibly important. And so I've had to upskill in a range of areas in order to become better at trying to engage those types of audiences as well.
Can I ask a question about that, engaging policymakers, meaning politicians? most, now I'm thinking as an American, and at least in America, I think one of the challenges for politicians that usually they do not overcome is that people want a short-term answer. And if you have, let's say, environmental issues or some issue that's going to take 30 or 40 years to correct, if you're a politician and say, this is going to take 30 or 40 years to correct, but I'm going to get us on the right direction, I don't think you're going to have a chance of getting elected. So for you as an academic, going to policymakers, I'm sure some of your proposals are not necessarily short-term proposals. Is that, do you have to really sort of finesse the way you make a presentation?
Well, look, in the UK, it helps to make these recommendations and to showcase research if it's coming from the Royal College of Music. I mean, we do have a certain place within society with supporters and connections that can help facilitate conversations. I would say that there are current practices within the UK that are moving in this direction. We've seen some efforts to what's called social prescribing, so through the National Health Service, of getting people in the public more engaged with a range of different things and not necessarily just prescribing medication all the time. So we are, you know, what we would want to do as well is to get our students engaged with creating opportunities for social prescribing. So I think there's a matter of working within existing frameworks and then also trying to propose new frameworks and new ways of thinking about problems. But yes, I mean, if it's not, you know, none of the stuff that we're talking about here in terms of music making an impact on mental health or aspects of loneliness, I mean, none of these are quick fixes. But, you know, the value for money is pretty good. If you look at treatments on depression medication and so on, the costs to society can be incredibly high. Whereas, you know, you can get a range of benefits from having a society that's engaging with the arts and music.
Well, your final project, just quickly, well, so, the MedTech, yeah, super connection. And then we get to the really interesting stuff.
So I'll skip that one, but I'll talk to you about. So one of the things that we're doing in our research is trying to use technology in a way to change how we can help support students practice their performance. So we are just now starting out on a new project with a major grant from our research council. That's going to allow us to upgrade a facility that we run at the college called the Performance Simulator.
So that was actually where I was going. So
so this Performance Simulator, I'll just mention this briefly. And so we have we're based in London in South Kensington, next door to Imperial College of Science, Technology and Medicine. And I have colleagues in the medical faculty there who train surgeons. They train people to perform, but in a completely different context. And you really do want your surgeon to be highly practiced before they're working on you, right? So I was interested in trying to understand how within the medical faculty, they are training surgeons to be really up to speed on delivering the very latest in medical advances, but also being able just to do the basics in terms of working with people. And they use simulation very, very often in order to give surgeons a chance to go in to get used to the sounds and the smells and the you know, the mess that you might find in an operating theater. So in looking at that and how they train surgeons in that context, I thought, well, why don't we create a virtual concert hall at the college, and we'll give our students a chance to go in and practice performing just as a surgeon might go in to practice an operation. So based on that rather naive idea, we looked around to see, well, how can we do this? We identified a small room within the college that we could transform into a performance space. It's a very small room, but we have this space set up where students can, they can book out a time, they're shown to the space, they're taken to a backstage area where they're met by a backstage manager. And, you know, in the backstage area, they can overhear the audience. They can't talk back there because the audience is just passed through the door. The backstage manager is busy looking at CCTV footage of the audience, dealing with the front of house, and the student is just standing waiting to go to be given the cue to go on. When the backstage manager gets the all clear from the front of house, he or she will turn to the student and say, "Okay, look, I'm going to open the door. You go out. I'll start applauding for you from back here as usual. You take your bow and you start performing whenever you're ready." The stage manager opens the door. The student walks out, and in front of them, they see they're hit by spotlights. And through the glare of the spotlight, there's an audience there that's applauding for them as they walk out. So they take a bow. The audience still may be applauding. They have to take two bows. But the audience that's there is entirely virtual. They're life-size, but they're projected on. And the backstage manager can control what they do from the backstage. So after the applause dies down and the students have taken the bow, they can just take a moment to get into the right mental space. They start their performance. We can insert various distractors if we want. We can have the audience cough and sneeze, and their phones can go off. They can do all sorts of things. At the end of the performance, we can also make the audience, applaud very enthusiastically. They can do a standing ovation. They can do a rather slow clap of death. They can even boo if we choose to make them do that. And the whole while, we have video cameras positioned around the space so that the student can watch their entrance onto stage, their performance, how they walked out, how they took a bow again, and so on and so forth. So we've got that simulation running. It was designed initially to be low cost and portable. We achieved that, and we've been running this for several years, and students can book into that space. In addition to the audience simulation, we also have an audition panel that we simulate. And again, we don't let the student just walk in to see the simulation. There's a staged process. So this is called distributed simulation. You tease the performer into that performance state of mind by giving certain cues, environmental cues that make them think this is for real. And what we see here is that in the backstage area, heart rate, blood pressure is going up, heart rate variability is going down, stress hormones like cortisol and cortisone are released into the body. In that backstage area, we see a peak level of reactivity. And then when students and most performers get onto stage, that calms a little bit, but it's not the same as you would find in a practice scenario. So what we're trying to do is just to work with students to devise a program for them so that when they come in, we know what they're aiming for with the session. We can change the audience or audition panel accordingly to try to achieve that. And then we give them a chance to practice performing. So initially, I set this up because I thought, well, we can use this as a space where people can work on issues with performance anxiety. And they do. And they can work in that space with a counselor or with a teacher. But what's been really interesting for me is that they've come up with uses for the space that I never really would have imagined. I mean, there are some students who come in, they just want a bit of repetition in the performance process, or they come in and they want to have a one-to-one lesson around performing, not necessarily around repertoire, or they want to come in and just look at those little polishing bits around walking onto stage, walking off stage. And they get videos, multiple angles of all of this. So that's what we've been trying to achieve. And it's a place where you can practice performing. You can even take risks in performing, but the risks aren't detrimental potentially to, there's not going to be a critic that's writing about you after you perform in the simulator. So just recently, we've started a brand new project. We're going to take that facility. We're going to completely transform it and upgrade it so that we can change the acoustic of the space to make it more responsive, to make it feel like different types of venues. Much more visually immersive as well, with three huge screens surrounding the student, entire motion capture systems in the space, so we get very detailed data. And we're taking all of that and duplicating it on a larger basis in a new space called the Performance Studio at the college. And in there, we're installing really state-of-the-art arrays of microphones and speakers, and we will actually be able to approximate the sense that you'll get if you're in a particular hall as well. So you can practice in Carnegie Hall in London without ever leaving our building. So that's what we're aiming to do. We're hoping to to upgrade and to reopen all these facilities ready to go in September or October of this year.
So if I was a student at the Royal College and let's say I have an audition coming up for an orchestra, how often would I be able to use that?
So we currently have the space open for bookings in every morning of the week. So you could book it in. It just kind of depends on availability. So you'd have to book early. We also try through some of the courses that we run to get. So we have a course for all first year students called Healthy Musician. And as part of that course, they're introduced to the lab, they're taken on a tour, and then they're alerted to the booking system at that point. Some students will come regularly. They may book in, you know, five times leading up to an audition. Some may come just on the first tour and not come back. That's fine. We just want to make this facility available.
It's a fantastic facility. I did go in and check it out just as I joined the college, and so you know I asked to see the different settings, and we were in the room, and they were showing them to us, and the audience setting is great, because you know as Aaron has said, there are different settings, so it can be like a welcoming audience, or you can have somebody booing at you, and it's kind of horrifying how it actually, although obviously you know that it's a screen, you know, of course it is, like that's it's right there, but the very real reaction that you feel when you see that or when you hear that. The other setting is for the audition panels, and I think there's three people on screen, and again there are a couple of different settings that you can have on that. To be honest, having been on audition panels myself, I'd say the kind of the most unwelcoming setting that you have available is probably the most realistic. You know, you get to 5 p.m., you're on audition number 22 for the day, and everybody's sitting there, you know, pushing a pencil around the table all day, you know, and you get all those noises, you get those responses, you get people sitting there checking their watch while on screen. And it's so unnerving. It really is an incredible facility.
Aaron, when you've done lectures on this and you've shown this audition panel and you've shown the different responses that they can give, like saying, "Wow, that was excellent, really happy to hear you," all the way to, I forget what the final negative response was, but every time in lectures when you show that, the audience laughs. And I forget what it was like. It was not like "don't come back," but I think we've heard enough.
Well, there's one where they can stop you in the middle and say, "Thank you, we've heard enough." There's another which is even more dispiriting than that, where the audition panel can say, they say, "Well, thank you for coming." And it's obvious that there's disappointment. So, you know, Jason's right. I mean, maybe we were too easy on that particular example. And the point isn't to necessarily scare students, but we want, you know, they're going to come across many different types of panels and audiences. So widening that range. Now, for the audition panel, we used actors in the UK who know very well what it's like to be in an audition. And so it was great to work with them to put this together. The new project, we will... In the larger space, in the performance studio, there will be huge screens surrounding the student. We will be projecting the inside of certain halls, and we will be working to people those halls with audiences that clap and boo and cough and sneeze and do all sorts of things like that. So, you know, we've got a technical work cut out for us, but it's a really fun project. And you know, I think, you know, as performers, it doesn't take much just to draw people right into that experience. Just playing a little bit of background noise of an audience murmur can be just enough to trigger that sense of something's different. And you know what what's really interesting is that when we see how people respond to performance, it's that backstage area before they go out where you see, you know, a real acceleration of how the body is responding to this. But that's a point where we can intervene. We can actually do something about it. So we can work systematically. We can use this space as a way to introduce new techniques to manage that sort of anxiety. The other thing too is that if you get a negative response, and we need to do more research on this, but looking at how negative responses affect the body. You know, I think in other areas we see that if you get something, you get some negative feedback, it can take the body, you know, maybe twice as long to recover and get back to a normal, you know, regular going state. And, you know, if you're a busy musician going from one gig to the next, you kind of want to get back normal as quickly as possible. And you know, we can look at interventions again to try to help speed up that process. We all talk about getting nervous typically, but it's also important to get over from being nervous as well. So there's the start and the finish that you have to deal with.
One of the great things that I heard was when I was a student at UCLA, my hero at that time was, his name is Bud Herseth, who played with the Chicago Symphony. And somehow somebody had made a reel-to-reel in those days, recording of, like, taken off of the radio of concerts. And there was a record. I'm sure he did this before people had piccolo trumpets even. So he did the Purcell Sonata in D major. And in the last movement, he played the opening line, and he went, bum ba da 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 dum ba da 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 dum ba da da da. And on that note, there's an unbelievably horrendous clam mistake. And then immediately, bum, 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 every note after that was just perfect. And for me, that was like the greatest demonstration of recovery, you know, from an accident and getting back on it.
One of my colleagues is a tuba player with the LPOs called Lisa Markulis, was telling me that one of the first concerts that he ever did was also Sprach Zarathustra with the LSO. He was doing second tuba, and Morris Murphy was playing first, and, you know, he kind of messaged all his friends being like, oh, you know, this is amazing, like, it just sounds absolutely amazing. Anyway, like, you know, got to the gig, and I think, you know, you can kind of tell the band had been away and, like, everyone was a bit tired. Anyway, they got to the gig and got to the bit in Arzo Sprach, and he split it.
On the concert?
In the concert, yeah, and he split it. And he said, and Lee just said, and he wasn't really quite sure what was going on, but he split it. And instead of, like, kind of bottling or anything like that, he just took a massive breath and had another go. I just played the concert C again. Just really, really loud, just went for it. We're like, yeah! And then, you know, did the diminuendo and everything. And he said it was just the most incredible display of being like, well, you know, you get it wrong, just have another go.
Yeah, wow, that's amazing.
I absolutely love that story, because it's just someone being like, you know what, just going to have another go.
And there's something about live performance as well. You know, the great study in Japan that was looking at audiences and their, you know, audiences were played performances that were recorded live and other performances that were recorded in the studio. And on the whole, audiences love those live performances. I mean, if I'm aiming for, I don't want to necessarily hear perfect, performances if I'm going live. I mean, it's about the being with people and hearing people and looking and just engaging generally. And that's a great thing to be able to do. And we missed all that during the pandemic, of course.
Do you think that there's going to be a time in the future, maybe the far off future, maybe the near future, where this distributed stimulation can be used by schools around the world?
Well, I would hope so. I mean, I've worked with colleagues in at McGill University at the Schulich School of Music to generate a similar sort of facility. It won't be quite the one that we're now building in London, but so, you know, I've done some advising there with also colleagues in Rotterdam at Codarts to try to develop a performance studio and performance lab space there too. So, you know, this sort of thing can happen. I mean, when I say it's low cost, we were able to generate the, you know, Mach 1 for maybe around £10,000. So maybe what $15,000 or something like that. Well, individually, and for some smaller schools, that could be a lot of money. And, you know, we've stepped that up with another grant of £100,000 and this latest grant of £2 million. So not every school is going to have access to that. But the basic principle is to say, well, look, we don't need to have all the bells and whistles necessarily, but it's about trying to get people to practice performing and to do that in using the different tools that we've got.
Join Aaron, Jason, and Tony in the bonus room, where they talk about the difference between stress and distress and how to relieve distress in a performance situation, including an idea that Jason calls flipping the script. Thank you for listening, and if you're enjoying these interviews, please be sure to subscribe and help us spread the word.